Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. All right, as we're repositioning here, if you want to go ahead and find your Bibles, you can, I'll just move this back here, and open up to Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6 is where we'll be at. So over the next couple weeks, we are going to, actually Mercedes came up with a great idea back months ago about taking some VBS stories and kind of looking at them from maybe a more adult perspective. So we are calling that Beyond VBS, right? And so we are going to look at five stories over the next 5 weeks that one of them may not have occurred in VBS, but we're going to just throw it in there anyway. And so we're going to look at Noah and the Ark. We're going to look at Abraham and Isaac when they go up on the mountain. We're going to look at, the fiery furnace, Daniel in the lion's den, Jacob wrestling with God, and then Ezekiel in the valley of dry bones. So those are kind of the stories we're going to look at. So today we're going to be with Noah and the Ark. Did you know that every habitable continent has at least one flood story? In fact, the Ark encounter in Kentucky says, in their center, says that there are over 200 flood stories around the world. From anywhere from the Native Americans in the Northwest Pacific to Central America to Pacific Island tribes to Africa to Aboriginals in Australia to China and India and anywhere in between. And a lot of those stories do share similar facts. For example, there's a flood, right? Certain righteous people are saved. Animals, boats are built. And so they share common threads. However, there are a lot of significant differences as well. So for example, one of the significant differences is the shape of the boat. So for example, in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is a geographically very close to, it's from, Epic of Gilgamesh comes from Babylon and Persia, so it's really close to Israel. Instead of a boat, the saving vessel is a cube. It's a cube, right? In another story from the Aboriginals in Northwest Australia, the boat is literally a raft. It is a flat-bottomed raft with a little tent on top. And then in another story, there's this thing called, I didn't know this word, I had to like Google the word. It's called a coracle. A coracle. It is like a bowl-shaped boat. It's literally round and looks like a bowl with a lid on top of it. I mean, like you're gonna cook dinner in it or whatever, you know. And so all of these stories around the world have similar things, some vastly different things. And so today we're going to look at what the Bible says about this story. Hopefully we'll answer some of your questions. I will tell you, we will not answer all of your questions, all right? And so I'm actually going to throw our tech person, Tucker, a curveball, and I'm going to throw you a curveball this morning, okay? And here's what I know on your outline. I hope you get an outline every Sunday. If you don't, you really should. Let me encourage you to look at your outline as we go along. You're not, like if your eyes are looking at your outline and you're not looking at me, I'm not going to hold it against you, okay? If you take notes, I take notes. That's fine. I'm not going to, like, that's, you get a gold star, okay? So on your outline, there are four parts to this story. And we're going to talk about all four of them. We're just not going to talk about them in the order that are on your outline. And here's why. The four parts are Noah, the boat, the flood, and God. So four important parts to this story. Because the outside two are the most important part. And so I want to save those for last, because I want to spend most of our time there. I don't want to spend most of our time on the boat and the flood, but that's probably where you're going to have the most of the questions, unfortunately. And unfortunately, we will answer some, we will not answer them all. So if you've got an outline, we're going to start with the boat. Okay? All right? So we're going to start with part number two, the ark. So Tucker, if you'll find 6, 14 through 16, here's what it says. Make for yourself, so these are God's words to Noah, make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you're to make it. The length of the ark, 300 cubits. Its breadth, 50 cubits. That's width. Its height, 30 cubits. Make a roof for the ark and finish it to a cubit above and set the door on the ark of the ark on the side and make it with lower, so first floor, second floor, and third floor, or decks is what the text tells us, okay? So that's the basic geometry of the boat. Now let's transfer that into feet. Now there's a variety, there's kind of a margin of error of how big the cubit is. So what I'm going to give you today is a little bit smaller than what, say, the ark encounter will give you. Their boat is actually a little bit bigger. It's at least 450 feet long. It's at least 75 feet wide, and it's at least 45 feet tall, and then with a roof over the top of it. And then the text tells us that Noah also adds a window, because at the end of the story, he opens a window, okay? So there's a door, really huge ark. It has three floors. Now, the ark encounter also says that they took all of the wood that they used to build their boat, or build their ark that you can literally go inside of today. If you were to stack all of that wood end to end, wood is measured in board feet. It's really weird. That's just how they measure wood. But if you were to take all of those board feet, 3.1 million board feet of lumber, and you were to stack it end to end, so like this, it would stretch from their site all the way to New York City. That's how much wood they just have in their boat, right? So approximately, Noah would have about that much, give or take, plus or minus a few percentage points in his boat. Now, this is free. I just thought about this. In the entire time it took for Noah to build the ark, that's kind of on your outline as well, it probably took about 75 years or maybe less than that to build this boat. I just thought he spent entire years just cutting trees down. I mean, unless there's some ancient technology we don't know about, but he's got a... They're working at two-man saw, right? He spent years of his life just cutting trees down. And that's just cutting them down. Then you've got to, like, mill them into lumber and boards and all of that, right? So it's an enormous project, right? So it takes... he spent probably 75 years at most on it. And then when he's finished with this boat, all of these animals show up. And so there's a little kind of confusion about the animals on the boat, but I want to kind of clarify that really quickly. There are two passages in the story, Genesis 6, 19 through 20, and 7, 2 through 3, that both talk about the animals that are on the boat. And so here's kind of how the animals work. Noah takes seven pairs. So seven times two is what? Good job. Way to go. All right. Seven pairs of clean animals, okay? That's like sheep, goats, cows, all the ones you eat, all those others, right? Okay, deer, antelopes, right? Then he takes one pair is how many? Of all the unclean animals. What are the unclean animals? Loggerhead turtles, tigers, lions, pigs. Oh, right? So that's how that works out. Again, you can go to the Ark Encounter website. They have, and if you go into the little search box and go, how many animals were on the boat? They have a detailed video on how they came up with all the different kinds, and that's the key word there, kinds of animals. So it doesn't mean that there were like 1,000 different dogs on the boat, right? It means there was two dogs on the boat, if that makes sense, right? And so they go into great detail about how they figured out the maximum number of kinds of animals and then the total number of animals that were on the boat. Needless to say, it's a lot, right? It's not as many as you would think, but it's a lot, right? A lot of animals. And so these animals then go on the boat. And then the text tells us that lastly, Noah was instructed to take every sort of food that is eaten. So they had vast stores of all kinds of foods for these animals to eat as well. So this was an enormous project, an enormous undertaking, because not only do you have to build the ark, then you have to store it with all of this food and water and all of this kind of stuff for these animals to survive, right? And so the next important part of, I know you've probably got 1,000 questions, but that's the ark, okay? Now, let's talk about the flood. Now, there's the interesting passage about the flood is, and we've got this one for the screen, is Genesis 7:11. 7:11. Now, let's read it together. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, now here's the key phrase, or two phrases. On that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of heaven were opened. So this is the beginning of the flood. And what does it say? All the fountains of the great deep burst forth. What is that talking about? Water underground. Right? Because it bursts forth of the great deep. Where is deep? Under. So it is so simultaneously. And then the windows of heaven, what does that refer to? Rain, right? So it is rain from up top and springs of water that come gushing up like a torrent. And it lasts for how many days? 40 days and 40 nights. Good job. All right. Y'all are getting gold stars all over the place. 40 days and 40 nights. And so you can see when you realize that there is water coming from underground and from above, and it lasts for 40 days and 40 nights, you can see how the entire earth is covered. In fact, the text tells us, and all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. And then goes on to say that they was covered to at least 22 feet above the highest mountain. Right? If you've ever watched these, like, I love the science shows that we don't watch them as much now because we all have the streaming and all this other stuff. But when I was a kid, I loved the like National Geographic and Discovery shows. And all these scientists would get up in these mountains and they're like, I wonder how all of these sea animals got fossilized up here. And as a kid, I was like, I know the answer. Noah. It's called a flood. And they just couldn't figure it out. And I'm like, it's right here, right? Right? And so the entire earth is flooded. Now, here's the bad side of the story. The bad side of the story is, and the text is very clear on this, everything, and this is the way it phrases, everything that breathes air through its nostrils, animal and man and woman, kid, humanity, and all the animals are dead. Like they die. Across the 40 days and 40 nights, all of the living animals that breathe air die. Just like that. Ugh. See, the ark is cool, right? Noah builds this big boat. All the animals are in there. God protects them until you realize that the flood also crushes everything that is alive, right? After this 40 days and 40 nights, there's no life left on earth. Now, here's how the text continues the story in chapter 7 and then into 8. In 7:24, it tells us that the water stayed on earth for 150 days. So it rained for 40 days and 40 nights, and then it stayed for 110 days after that. Then in 8:3, it tells us that God started the process of receding the waters, which took another 150 days. So 150 plus 150 is? Good job. All right. And then after 40 more days, in between this, the ark with all the animals and Noah on it comes to rest on Mount Ararat. And after 40 more days, Noah opens a window. And then there's a process whereby Noah lets out birds to see if there's land. And eventually a dove comes back with an olive branch. Quick little thought. If the earth was flooded for 300 days, how did the olive branch have a branch? How did the olive tree have a branch? Just food for thought. Okay? So, again, questions we will not answer in this service, but you can go Google them, right? All right? So, So Noah, and then finally he lets a dove out and it doesn't come back, meaning there's trees and all the dove can light on and it's good, right? And then this story tells us in 8:16 that in the 601st year, the second month, and the 27th day, God gives Noah the command to go out of the ark with all his family and with all the animals, right? So it's 1 year and 10 days. 1 year and 10 days, Noah and his family, his sons and their wives, and all those animals were on the ark. Did y'all ever watch that? You younger kids may not have seen this. Y'all remember the show with John Travolta, Grease? Oh, loved it. Watched it all the time as a kid. Right, love the show. Do you remember the ending scene when they let out of school for the summer? And kids are just like pouring out of the high school? Y'all remember that? That's what I see when I see Noah. In this verse right here, in chapter 8, verse 16, when God says, everybody's, y'all can leave. And the door opens. I imagine that scene. People, animals are just, raw. It is like a stampede of humanity and animals and everything just flying out of the ark. It reminds me of that scene in the movie Grease. And that's what I see. That they are running out and they are going out to do what God created them to do. So we've got two parts of the story. There's the ark and the flood. Now I want to focus on the two most important parts, and that is Noah and God's work. So let's look at Noah to begin with. Noah appears on the scene all the way back in chapter 5, verse 29. His father's name is Lamech, and here's what Lamech says when Noah's born. Out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands. Now, probably more than Lamech knew, that was very prophetic about Noah's life. Just probably not in the way that he thought it would be, right? So then we go on down, and chapter 6 tells us that there's a major problem in Noah's world. And it says that every intention and every thought of human's heart was continually evil. Did you hear that? Let me read it again. Every intention of the thoughts of his heart, of humanity's heart, was evil continually. But in the midst of that, Noah is a shining light of difference. Let's read verses 6 through 8. 8 through 9, excuse me, chapter 6, 8 through 9. Let me read them. Now I want you to listen to the language very carefully because we're going to go over this in detail. You ready? But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Verse 9. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was right, was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God. Read them both together, but go back to verse 8. Let's read it again. Listen. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Verse 9. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God. Let's talk about these three first. Go back to that phrase, found favor. Righteous man. What does it mean for Noah to be a righteous man? It means that Noah was doing the right thing. It means he was in right standing with God. It means he was guiltless. He was faultless. What does it mean for Noah to be blameless? Blameless means that Noah was free of shame. He was complete. He was whole. And what does it mean for Noah to walk with God? It means that Noah was going on the course God was going on. He was going in the direction God was going. And interestingly enough, in the Old Testament, only two of all the people in the Old Testament, only two are this little epitaph is used of. They walked with God. Enoch and Noah. That's it. From Genesis to Malachi, there's only two people in the Old Testament. Not David, not Solomon, not all the people, not Abraham even. Noah and Enoch are said to walked with God. They were going on the same course that Noah was going on. Now we come back to verse number 8 where it says, Noah found favor with God. And I've got an interesting question I want to ask you this morning. And we are hit in the face with this question in the 6th chapter of Genesis. And you may go, what? But listen to me. I'm going to say it twice. Listen. Did Noah find favor in God's eyes because he was righteous? Or was Noah righteous because he found favor with God? Here's my question. What came first? Noah's righteousness or finding favor with God? This is important. You may think, I don't understand what you're talking about. We're going to get there. This is important. All right, here's why it's important. And here's how we're going to look at it. Word order. Word order. And definitions. All right, let's talk for a minute. Word order. What word order do we see these two things occurring in the scripture? Well, we see found favor first, and then we see these righteousness, blameless, and walk with God. Now, if they were reversed, if verse 8 said, but Noah was righteous and blameless and walked with God, and then verse 9 said, and Noah found favor with God, then we would assume, based off the text, that because Noah was righteous and doing good things, that that's why God went and said, hey, I like you. You're going to be my guy. But the word order is not that, is it? What's in verse 8? Or Noah found favor with God. So that means Noah's finding favor with God preceded his right actions. Righteousness, blamelessness, walking with God. So the word order would lead us to believe that Noah found favor before all of these things. Righteousness, blameless, walking with God. Now, let's make it even more clear, and in my estimation, even more better. Definitions. Now, when I read this passage, and when you read this passage, we cannot help, and this is true for any Bible passage you read, we cannot help but to bring baggage with us when we read the Bible. Sometimes that's good baggage, and sometimes that is bad baggage. And in this case, this translation, found favor, does not help us any because we bring bad baggage to us, with us, that negatively impacts the way we understand this passage. I'll give you a great example. Great example. All right? Let's assume you're in a VBS class this year. Some of you will be. Some of you may have been, but you're working with kids. Miss Beth's our teacher here. Some of our other teachers are not here today. Aaron's over there keeping kids. Miss Beth, if I were to, I'm putting you on the spot, okay? And Miss Kenya, you can answer this too. Either one of y'all can answer, okay? You will have the same answer, okay? If you were to say, man, that kid's my favorite. We know, in theory, you don't have favorites in class, but we all know you do. Okay? What would your response be to why that kid's your favorite? Feel free. This is your moment. You've got to say it loud. Good behavior. Great answer. They're obedient. Right? And so we would equate, but here's the point. When that kid, the first day of class, came into your class, were they your favorite? No. Why? Because you don't know how they're going to act. And it's only after they've been obedient and had good behavior that they become your favorite. They had to earn it. Oh, great. You just soft-tossed for that for me, Miss Beth. Thank you. Right? Right? They had to earn it, right? And so when we bring, that is the exact attitude. I did not prep her, by the way, beforehand. Just want y'all to know. All right, I should have. That was really awesome. All right, but in the way we understand finding favor is you have to earn it, then you get it. So when we come to this text and we read, but Noah found favor with God, our baggage is Noah must have been doing something right in the first place for him to earn the right to find favor with God. Okay? But is that really what this verse is trying to say? Absolutely not. And it all deals with definitions. See, what would be a better word? We're going to change one word, the word favor. It's not because favor is wrong or a bad word for this text. It's absolutely accurate. But our baggage hinders us from seeing what's really going on in this passage. So I'm going to change it to one word you all know, grace. Because that's what it's getting at. So let me read it to you now. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. That word, changing that word alone, totally transforms the way we read this passage. You want to know why? Because the Bible defines grace for us very well. Right? The Bible clearly defines grace as what? Unearned, free gift. Paul says it. What does he say? By grace you are saved. Thank you, Miss. Not of yourselves. So that no one can boast. Right? Paul says that because we all would boast. Look at what I did. Right? So what's really going on in this passage? Was it Noah earned the right to be in favor with God? No. It was God in his sovereign will said, Noah, I am going to bestow grace upon you. And therefore, out of that, grace being poured on Noah's life, and that grace being allowed to flourish inside of Noah, produced righteousness, blamelessness, and walking with God. So let me put it to you this way. The actions of Noah, righteousness, blameless, walking with God, are only the outward demonstrations of what God had already done in Noah's heart on the inside. So it is not that Noah earned favor. It is that he was given grace that produced righteousness, blameless, and walking with God, which absolutely put him against the way everybody else was living in the world. It is God's grace that caused Noah to look different in his generation. Right? And that's why when God says, hey, Noah, I want you to build a boat and this size and this side, and Noah's doing the math in his head, he doesn't go, but God, what is rain? He starts cutting wood down and building a boat. Right now, he may have asked God, what is rain? And that's fine. But my point is, because of God's grace working in his life, causing him to be this way in his character and nature, it caused him to go, yeah, God, I'll build a boat. An enormous boat. And yeah, I'll take in all these animals. Yeah, I'll do that. Right? And so Noah, we see Noah is a key figure in the story, but the most important figure in this story is God's work, because God is the main actor in the story of Noah. We see that in a multitude of ways, but I'm going to give you three this morning. Number one, God is the one who shuts the family in the ark. I love that little passage. If you're reading the story, you'll quickly read over it, and it says, and God shut the door. Right? What does that show us? It shows us that God was going to be the one that was protecting them from whatever was going to happen. Noah and his family, there's no way they could have known what was going on. They were probably as shocked as the animals were when water gushed up from the earth and rain poured, and it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. But God knew what he was going to do, and he therefore was a refuge for Noah and his family for the entire duration of this cataclysmic event. And through this, we see that God is a refuge. Here's a big word. This story is an archetype. It is a type of story that we see for the rest of the Bible. It is solidified in the wisdom literature, specifically in Psalms and Proverbs. Let me read you a couple. Psalm 16:1, preserve me, O God, for in you I take refuge. Psalm 28:8. Here's what it says. The Lord is the strength of his people. He is the saving refuge of his anointed. And lastly, Psalm 61:3. For you have been my refuge, a strong tower against the enemy. What God does here as a saving refuge for this family becomes what God does for his people from this point forward. And we see that over and over and over and over and over again, all the way through, even into the revelation of John at the end of the Bible. Secondly, God remembers them. In Genesis 8:1, it says, "But God remembered Noah and the beast and all the livestock that were with him on the ark." Now, this does not mean that God forgot about him because he was dealing with some other galactic need. It simply means that God, that Noah and his family and the animals were on God's mind continually, and that he was not going to let them linger any longer on the ark than they absolutely had to be. Number three, lastly, God covenants with Noah and creation. God initiates the covenant process at the end of the story. God initiates the covenant process, and he does so by putting a sign in the sky. We know that today as the rainbow. Now, here's the interesting thing about the rainbow. In the text, it doesn't say rainbow. It says bow, right? God put his bow in the sky. Now, we understand that to be the rainbow. But here's the interesting thing. The word bow used here is the same word used throughout the Old Testament for the bow, for hunting and killing, for hunting animals and in use of war. It is the exact same word. Now, here's the cool part, and it is evidence of God's covenant with humanity. Think about this with me. Which way is the rainbow situated? This way. Right? Okay? Right. Now remember, the bow, in this case, is a bow of peace. But depending on your use of a bow, it can be a weapon of war. Right? Now, if I am shooting a bow at you, which way does the curve of the bow go? Towards you or away from you? Towards you. So if I am shooting the bow and you're the enemy, the bow is which way? That way. So think about it this way. God created, here's my point, I'm giving you the point. God created the physics and all of that to show that this bow was a bow of peace and not of war. Because had God wanted the bow in the sky to remind him, to remind all of us, hey guys, I can wipe y'all out in a minute, the rainbow would not go this way. It would go this way. Right? And you say, oh, that can't happen. You don't mean the God who created the universe could create the physics to make the rainbow go the other way? You understand what I'm saying? Like, the bow, since the rainbow goes this way, the rainbow is pointing up, which means it is a bow of peace for us and for all of us, for all of Earth. Had God not wanted that to be, he could have created the physics so the rainbow points down at us as a reminder, hey, don't mess around with me. I'll kill all of y'all. Remember, I done it once. But that's not the message that God wanted to create with his covenant. So he puts the rainbow in the sky as a symbol of peace and that God would not destroy the earth again by water like he did here. And so God covenants with his people. God remembers Noah and his family and all the animals. And God shuts the family in as a refuge from all this. And so when we take all of these, God's work, the ark, the flood, and Noah, and Noah's grace that he receives and all that, what can we take home today from this story? There's a lot. There's really a lot of application points that we can make. For example, we could talk about how God saves. Clearly he does. We could talk about how God always has a remnant. He does. We could talk about how God rewards righteousness and punishes evil. We could talk about how God is a covenant-making God, and this is one of many covenants that God makes. But there's one idea that I want to hone in today, and it is simply this. It's very simple. It is that God's grace changes life. Right? God's grace changes life. Simply put, why in the world would Noah spend 50 to 75 years building one boat? And most, like, early Genesis scholars will tell you that he may have never seen rain. Like, it may not have rained yet. So God's telling him something's going to happen that he's never seen to build this enormous boat that's going to house all the kinds of animals on earth. And Noah just goes, okay. And then, in staggering accomplishment, maybe even greater, convinces his three sons that they need to join him in this epic building project. Why would he do that? There is one answer: God's grace. Because God's grace changes lives. God's grace turns our lives into a testimony of righteousness, blamelessness, and walking with God. Grace turns our lives into the antitype of the world. And we live in a very similar world that Noah did. There are a lot in our own community whose continual thought is what? Evil. Watch the news 1 week and you will hear, you will find out. Right? You don't have to go far. Read the discussion page. Right? You don't have to go far to understand that evil is everywhere. And we at times live in a very dark world. But grace changes our lives into something that is completely and totally different than what the world is offering. And when grace reigns supreme in our hearts and minds, we build boats. We give generously. Hey, we talked about tithing back in February. Hey, let me give you a attaboy, attagirl. Since then, you have increased your tithing. I am so proud of that. Super proud. Y'all have done a great job. Let's keep it up for the rest of the year. Like, so proud of y'all. So proud of y'all. But listen to me. The only way you will move into greater generosity in your life is if God does a heart change in you, because ain't ne'er one of us want to be generous on our own. You want to know why? I know that. Let's go walk over here to the nursery and try to take one of those little kids' toys. It will not end well for anybody in the room. They will get mad. They will holler. You will get mad. You will be frustrated. And it will be a bad day, because in and of ourselves, we are not generous people. But God, through His grace and through His mercy, can change our hearts to see that generosity is enormously better than selfishness. In the same way, grace changes us to serve others, to engage people, to go on mission trips, to, like our friends last week came and spoke, to start a mission movement in another country. God's grace changes our hearts so that we share the gospel of Jesus in multiple ways wherever we go. And God's grace can change your heart and your life even still today as we continually grow closer to Jesus.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.